Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. So, the National are one of the best, most consistent, and most persistent rock bands of this century. Not that there's a super ton of competition, but they are really great. They were once based in Brooklyn, now they're based basically all over. They make music for grown-ups, which is a rare and, I would argue, wonderful thing here in 2017. And they have a new album that is as strong as anything they've ever done. We have Matt Berninger from The National right here. Hey, Matt.
How are you?
I'm good, man. Thanks for being here. Let's hear from the new album, The System Only Dreams in Total Darkness.
Maybe I listen more than you think, and I can tell that somebody sold you. We said we'd never let anyone...
Matt, one time we spoke and you told what seems to be a sort of semi-origin story of The National, and the vision is of you sitting, I don't know if it was on a porch, but I picture it on a rainy day, sitting slightly depressed while you had a day job with headphones on, I think listening to maybe Nick Cave and sipping whiskey. And then, The National makes all kinds of music. I think one of the strains of music is a kind of music that would be very appropriate to listen to while you sit on your porch contemplating the universe and sipping whiskey.
I'll admit, wine and vodka, I like the lighter, whiskey I had some troubles with. Not troubles, I just bad nights, and so, but everything else seems pretty accurate so far, go ahead.
I mean, how would you describe the mission statement of The National, if you could?
Today or back then?
Both, perhaps.
I was in a band before The National, and so Scott and I were in a band called Nancy in college with college friends, and so were the other guys, a different band. And then I think our mission statement of Nancy was try to sound like Pavement and have fun and we did, we made a record and stuff, but we played a couple of gigs in Cincinnati, but they were in that scene. And the other guy's band, Project Nim, was a very, very, more of like a college, it wasn't a jam band, but it was like a 10,000 Maniacs sort of thing. So we, both of our bands, we were on the outskirts of the kind of Southern Ohio cool scene that had, you know, it started with, you know, Afghan Whigs or later, and then Brainiac and then Breeders and Guided by Voices and all that kind of stuff. So there was like a big, there was a scene. So I think our mission statement then was just to try to be able to compete with Brainiac, you know, and there was a show at Casey's in basement that members of Brainiac came. And I think my funny thing is my parents also came. And my memory is that Juan Monasterio was talking during while we were playing, and my dad asked him to be quiet, and then he left. So our shot at impressing Brainiac was over quickly after two songs, because my dad asked him to be quiet. So he didn't know what he was doing, Dad. So back then, I think we just kind of wanted to have fun and compete with, you know, the bands that we were seeing, you know, at Bogart's and Sudsy Malone's in Cincinnati. Yeah.
And
now,
yeah.
Now, our mission statement individually is probably all completely different. You know, we don't have a band mission statement anymore. You know, actually, we never did. Mine now, my mission statement is be as kind to my friends and family as I can, and to be as brave as I can, you know, and those kind of go, they become the same things pretty quickly, bravery and kindness. And make some art. And have fun.
The new album is called Sleep Well Beast, and it's out on September 5th. The title track is, which is not released to the public yet, is pretty wild. It's kind of emblematic of the experimentation on this album. There's a lot of sort of electronics going on. It goes in a lot of different directions. It seems like you said that the idea behind this album was there was a little bit of anything goes. You were trying to break out in a bunch of ways. Is that correct?
Well, we didn't know what we were trying, but everybody had been trying a lot of different things, you know, not just in between the last two records, but even way before that. Between our last two records is the first time I actually, you know, put out another music project.
With Elvi, yeah.
Yeah, with Elvi. But those guys had been doing that for a while in various forms. I mean, and, you know, collaborating with Sufjan and Justin and Vernon and Richie and from Arcade Fire. So those guys have been out there, Aaron and Bryce particularly, have been out there collaborating and doing a lot of different things. So, and that stuff always brought back stuff. They literally would bring Richie and Sufjan and Justin and Annie and everybody and Sharon Vinette and You know, and they literally bring them back to the studio to work on our records. So that sort of like open door policy and open experimental policy or whatever has been there for a while. I think this record was, we just had more time to let all those, just let other stuff in the room and let other ideas percolate, and all that kind of stuff. And it resulted in this collection, you know, and it's not a concept album or something, but it's all interconnected, and dots do connect here and there and stuff like that.
And it is about, to a certain extent, about marriages in trouble. Again, a very tween friendly topic.
I was singing about being in a troubled marriage way before I ever met my wife and everything. I wrote Slipping Husband, I think, when I can't remember how old I was when I said, but my point is that it's there's a lot of stuff about marriage. It's not about marriage. It's about relationships, and some of it is about my marriage, some of it's about my relationship. I mean, I've been in a relationship with these guys in the band long way before I met my wife and everything. So, and sometimes there's literally family involved, and it's not so specifically autobiographical about my marriage, but the idea of commitment and relationships and evolution of relationships is woven throughout it. Yeah.
And you, of course, collaborate on lyrics with your wife. It's important to point out. Yes. Yeah, so
since four or five records, since Boxer.
Yeah. On a side note, apparently you guys are writing a TV show together, or tried to write a TV show together.
we are still doing it. Ask me in a year from now. It may have been tried. But yeah, Tom and Corinne and I are developing a TV show.
So the sound of this record, was there a key moment when you knew it was coming together, when you found a direction?
I mean, I mean, Aaron started sending me sketches 3.5 years ago. Right.
Wow.
You know, even though we talk about like taking breaks and going on hiatuses and whatnot, like all it takes is somebody to email somebody an idea, and that sparks somebody. Like, you can't resist it. And next thing you know, two years go by, and you have about 20 or 30 things that you've been going back to and opening up folders and working on it. So the thing came together pretty organically. But about a year ago is when we kind of like, it looks like we got a record coming together, you know, and then we really start digging in, and then we really start coming together and literally working on it all and start to pick and choose which things to focus on. So that happened, I don't know when that happened, but a year and a half ago. But I got excited about this record about 3.5 years ago when Aaron sent me that first sketch. So
whiskey has been abandoned for wine, largely. I also get a sense, and you are living in California, I get a sense that that weed may be playing a part in your consumption lately.
Did you get a sense from that, from this interview or from other interviews that I've done?
From lyrics and yeah.
Listen, I'm a law abiding American, and
in California it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So and then here's the reality about that. I never smoked weed at all. I smoked weed when, you know, a couple times in college, and had terrible, terrible experiences. Like, you know, lock yourself in the closet and draw the devil type of thing. because that's what you read somewhere that happens, because some PSA said that that's what's going to happen. So I did that. I was like, oh, that is true. So I never smoked weed, you know, until I moved to California, and then I started smoking a bit, and it's it's been great.
Have you found it has shaped your creative process at all, or the direction?
It's influenced it for sure. It's like, although I was moving this direction before, where I edit myself less, clearly, and just kind of enjoy the process of create even all the bad ideas. Here's the thing: is like when you're weed does relax your critical. Being so critical of everything, even yourself and everyone else, and it allows you to sort of like kind of move forward and have lots of ideas and not be like filled with all the self-loathing of everyone and your ideas is terrible, even though 9 out of 10 of them probably are terrible. So it's been a catalyst for just relieving some of the anxiety of writing. And I think a lot of people smoke a little weed before they go to work in the morning. I'm not saying it's a good idea, but like, especially as like you work on some sort of manual labor thing or anything, or even like working in a restaurant, it's a catalyst for actually getting good work done too. It's not about It's not about eating chips and playing video games. People have been using this for multiple reasons for centuries for all kinds of things. So.
Truly medicinal, yes.
I'm such a nerd too. I'm one of those new weed smoking nerds who can't stop talking about it. Where people who've been smoking since the '60s are like, ugh, you know, it's like somebody talking about like Bush ice beer, you know, or something like that. Like, oh, I'm really into those iced beers because they're so much cleaner and pure. Anyway.
So we started out by playing a little bit of the System Only Dreams in Total Darkness, which would have been a cool album title too, I have to say.
Yeah.
But tell me about that song. Tell me about the how the music came together. Tell me about the lyrics to the extent that you're comfortable.
Okay. A lot of these things came from stuff way back that Aaron, a little piano sketch or a guitar sketch or something, some stuff from Bryce. But that one actually, the sketch of that, was called Haunt, and I think the sketch of that happened in a room together with the whole band up in upstate, or that could have been Venice, California. But anyway, there was a sketch called Haunt that had that, and that was just like we were playing with different guitar things, and that riff I really loved, and then we just built a song around that riff. I don't know who plays that riff, either Aaron or Bryce. I know Aaron plays the solo, but I'm not sure he plays the riff that kind of became the foundation for that sketch. And that sketch was called Haunt, and we were fighting about that song for a long time because it just never quite seemed right. We were changing the drums. We kept trying to change everything. The only thing that we didn't change was the everything else we kept changing around it. And the guitar solo was just like, that's, you know, so we kind of built the song around those things, but it wasn't working until the night before we were supposed to be kind of be done with the record. And it was my wife was like, listen, I found an old version of that sketch Haunt that had some different lyrics on it. One of which some mumbled version of the System Only Dreams in Total Darkness. So overnight, Corinne and I kind of rewrote all the lyrics to that. In the morning, this was normally it would have caused a great deal of anxiety and stress to like suddenly, you know, rewrite and have to re-record all the vocals and lyrics and everything for a song. And that more than that changed too, like on the day you're supposed to like send it off to master. But I worked all night and then my wife and I, like she was in LA. I worked as long as I could. Then she worked and then sent me her ideas overnight. And I woke up early at 5 and went back to work. And when Aaron showed up at 9 in the morning, I played him what we had on, you know, it still needed to be finished and done, and you know, we had to pull the thing apart, but you could tell it was going to be better. So that turned into System Only Dreams and Total Darkness, and you know, kind of that phrase was a free associated thing, and then the rest of it kind of got crafted around it, the rest of the lyrics. And then there was one other song that spawned off of that sketch Haunt, and that was Turtleneck, and that was
I love that song. Yeah. That reminds me of some older National stuff. It's great. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that's the sort of cathartic post Trump win moment, even though he's not really mentioned, but it's just that song is simply medicinal, you know, personally. And yeah. But so that was came from the same sketch Haunt, from that same session where we just that jam where, and again, Corinne was like, why don't you just take the really loud part and just loop that, and that's just make a short song just with the super loud part. That's how that started, and it turned to Turtleneck. That one was written, you know, really quickly too. So those two songs, System Only Dreams and Turtleneck, are from this sketch called Haunt that came from a jam session, which is kind of rare for us, less so now, and then spawned those two songs that were like, you know, recklessly and quickly written, sort of.
Let's talk briefly about Turtleneck. That by the way, has in the chorus, keep the weed next to the bed, light the water, check for lead. So the line I was interested, I think a bunch of people have pointed to, is the poor, they leave their cell phones in the bathrooms of the rich. And when they try to turn them off, everything they switch to is just another man in shitty suits that everybody's cheering for. This must be the genius we've been waiting years for. So a little bit of Trump in there, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously about Trump. And
I think I'd be perfectly... Yeah, they're good suits cut poorly, to be clear, but yes.
I just, the image, though, of that line, the poor, they leave their cell phones in the bathrooms of the rich, of course, is because, like, oh, I can, just the image of that man just tweeting his hate, you know, on his toilet is that just happens every morning. And I just, like, because it's happening literally every morning. And so that's a little bit of it. And then, but there's also a Leonard Cohen line that I'm kind of stealing from, or just reforming, where they it's something, the rich, they leave their cameras in the bedrooms of the poor, I think is Cohen's line. So it's a kind of a flip of that.
You're just taking all old Leonard Cohen lyrics and making them about Twitter. That's
just repurpose them for the modern age. That's probably be good.
So it is interesting. You guys have taken heat for that very idea. People have called you a new kind of dad rock. I think someone once said, and I do think this is kind of funny. Someone said the National Make Music for Sad Lawyers, which
my favorite was Brunchcore.
It is an interesting thing because I think part of it is coming against a climate and criticism that is anti-rockist or pro-poptimist or whatever we are, post-poptimist, wherever we are in criticism, where just an ambitious rock band with smart lyrics, which used to be for years the kind of thing that was absolute catnip for the critical world, is not necessarily anymore. Although, of course, you guys get plenty of great reviews, but there is that interesting thing in the discourse. How aware are you of that?
I mean, there's still the craving on a mainstream level for great lyrics. I mean, that's why Kendrick Lamar and that's why he's as big as he is. You know, that's why Kanye and Beyonce and that's why hip hop actually is dominant, because it's the best writing, I think, on a lot of levels. So I wouldn't say that an appreciation for good writing has disappeared necessarily. Or claim that. I mean, I think I'm a good writer, I think. But yeah, there is some sort of disdain a little bit in the mainstream music world for a type of band. Well, probably because it just got overlauded, you know? Mm. I mean, like, people have been just like, you know, just dropping at the feet of Dylan or the Beatles or the Stones and, you know, forever, to the point where it's like we have enough coffee tables, you know, coffee table books of those dudes. I mean, we do, you know.
I literally just did a coffee table book on David Bowie, so I'm deeply offended. No, go on.
No, yeah. No, I mean, but I'm sure I pre-ordered it, you know, because they're all my heroes. But there's also a good point about, like, there's a certain thing that you can do with guitar bands that after a while you start to just recycle the same ideas, which is, I'm not, and it is exactly a lot of what we're doing, I admit, but that's what jazz does, and that's why there's more doors being opened in hip hop right now. There just are.
Yeah.
So it makes sense. And so I'm not in no way offended by the fact that rock and roll in general is on its way out. It's just still what we, it's still the game we play, you know.
It's funny, I was talking to Josh Homme from Queens of the Stone Age, and he described basically threatening to punch out an Interscope Records executive who told him that rock is on its way out. So don't say that to Josh. Josh,
no, I was
going by it. Yeah. Just an important safety tip.
Shit. I think Josh knows where I live, so I hope he doesn't listen. No, Josh is, I don't think, Josh is smart. I get his point for defending his craft. You know, I'm with him there too. I defend my craft, but I do, I'm aware of, you know, the big picture is the big picture makes sense to me. I do think there is a high quotient of dumb music though. But there always has been, you know, so it's not like that's new.
For sure. The song Walk It Back has a bit in it where this has to be the only album I've ever heard that has a long spoken word passage taken from a New York Times magazine article.
Kids love that shit.
again, this is all for the kids. There's an infamous quote. Many people believe it was from Karl Rove, the former Bush strategist, and it had to do with the reality-based community which he had exempted the Bush administration from. How did that bit end up in that song? It's pretty haunting in context.
Ron Suskind wrote the piece, but I think he wrote it originally, interviewed Karl Rove, yeah, who apparently still does not cop to being the person who said those words out loud in the White House. But yeah, it was said in the White House by someone to Ron Suskind, who was there for the New York Times. And then Ron Suskind repurposed it after Trump won, and that's where I again saw it, and it struck another chord, and it struck a special chord after Trump won, because it's somebody saying out loud what one of the things we fear most is that when, you know, he said when we can control what people understand is real or true, we can do whatever the F we want to, right? That's what he said. And he said it out loud. It's like, you guys are in the reality-based community. Well, you'll hear the quote. It's terrifying. So I couldn't get it out of my head. So I repurposed it and had Lisa Hannigan speak it. She's also, Lisa Hannigan's brilliant. She's on the record a bunch. And she also does the voice in Steven Universe of Blue Diamond. And I just thought that'd be a perfect voice to read this quote, this dark evil poetry that came from the mouth of apparently Carl Rove. The other funny part about it is that Ron Suskind wants some publishing for it, which I was like, that's fine, but you have to get split it with Carl.
Does he really?
Yeah. I want to bait Carl by saying, listen, you get, you know, five, you know, you're going to get $20 or $100 a year of publishing for this if you admit that you said it in the White House. I lied about part of it. I said it was written in a red Sharpie on a whiteboard and anything, you know, and that's fake news from me.
Another, so you've released, I think, three songs from the new national album, which is called Sleep Well Beast and is out in September. Another one is Corinne at the liquor store.
I was a worm, I was a creature, I'd get on the ground. The second I'd see you, you cannot command your love.
Tell me about that song. Tell me, you know, besides getting the world to pronounce your wife's name correctly, what was the impetus?
Well, she didn't want her name in the song. Ah. And not only did I put it in, I named the song that. I doubled down. That song is really important to Aaron. And the music came to me for that. And Aaron plays the piano in a way that nobody else does. And the minute he sent me that one, it was just one of those ones I just like, okay, that's... I you know, it's one of those things you just, it's too, I just kept going back, couldn't go back to it, you know, or couldn't stop going back to it. And just, I just poured a lot of feeling into that because it just wanted me, because he did, and it was all there. So, and I know he was writing a lot, his mother-in-law who passed away this past year, you know, she was diagnosed with cancer and she died, while we were making this record, and that was her favorite thing too. So it was a really important thing. The record's dedicated to her. So, and it was important to me too. So I wanted to put as much as my, so, you know, just a love song, about and to my wife. And it's not so specific. It's not all this stuff, you know, I have never seen the corpse of John Cheever. I was not there, and he was surrounded by his, I think there's something about that line. He was surrounded by his wife and family when he died. And that was a complicated, brilliant artist with you know, all kinds of issues or I won't call them issues. I'll call them, complications, you know, but he died surrounded by his family in the arms of love. And, you know, and it's a centerpiece kind of emotionally for all of us in some ways, or at least I know for me and I know for Aaron.
When you have a rhyme like Keeper and John Cheever, is that, it's pretty brilliant. It's also like, is it part of you? It's like, is that too clever? Or is, again, like self-editing is, you're trying to do less of it?
No, I mean, that's a good thing. That's where my wife is very helpful, which, I mean, she's like, she was an editor. And so I, you know, sometimes you can tip the balance in something being too silly or too obtuse or too not obtuse, you know, and all that stuff. And she's a really good ear for tone and all that stuff. And, Tom Waits and his wife write together too. And he describes it as, she washes and I dry, but, I think ours is different. I think I spill out lots and lots and lots of ideas, and she combs through it and tells me where I'm like kind of going, you know, going in the same territory too much or sound false. And then, you know, then she'll give me some lines, and some of the best national lines are hers.
And the third song that's available is Guilty Party. So let's hear a little bit of that and then talk about it. Mm-hmm.
You're sleeping night and day.
So what was the process behind that one?
That one is another version of a sketch that split into two songs, like an egg dividing. Hmm. And the egg was a sketch called Black Barn. And Aaron and Bryce and those guys were really, really working hard on that one and developing something, which turned into Sleep Well Beast, the song Sleep Well Beast. That's the last song, which is kind of, you know, a whole different type of thing. And just in terms of what that song is about, yeah, it's a breakup song, you know? Mm. And is it about my marriage? Yes and no. Is it about the band? Yes and no. Is it about, you know, whatever, United States of America? Not that much, but a little, you know. I don't know. It's a breakup song, you know.
Was Born to Beg, did that start with the title just because it's such an alluring title, especially when you have Born to Run and Born to Lose by Social Distortion? It's just a tempting framework for a title.
That was a sketch where I started playing it And then it kind of just one of the very first things that stuck was me singing that chord, like I was born to beg for you, and it was real organic. And I was like, and I remember thinking, well, there must be a song called Born to Beg out there, right? And there wasn't. I don't think there is. Maybe there is. There's a song called pretty much everything out there. Somewhere.
Sure.
The System Only Dreams in Total Darkness 2 was because there's another version of that somewhere. No, I'm kidding. That one doesn't. That's on its own. But yeah, sometimes a song just like hinges on a chorus, you know.
For sure. And now we're also going to be joined by Brian Devendorf, drummer for The National. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Brian. How are you?
Good. So I'll tell a brief story about something I once saw, which is that Brian is the only rock drummer where I've ever seen this. I believe that I was once, I was in your studio in Brooklyn, and I saw that you had actually written out a score. You actually had written out a score for a drum part.
A drum score.
Yeah, which I just had never seen before in a rock context. Obviously, you have some serious training. How does it help to write the stuff out?
Well, that's how I started. I had a drum teacher by the name of Elmer Monk who pirated some Led Zeppelin sheet music, you know, just like the drum beats notated out.
I thought Steve Earle taught you drums.
Well, Steve Earle was the initial contact, but he had to quit teaching to go on to the Afghan Whig. So he recommended this other guy. Hey, I know this guy, Elmer. You should check him out. So through Elmer, I learned, I'd already taken violin, so I knew how to read like basic notation. Drum music is much, much easier typically because there's no notes, but just, you know, things you hit. So yeah, it just helps so you don't forget things, just to give me that level of confidence while I'm recording. So I know I can just glance, it's like a cheat sheet.
In the world of rock and roll, it's pretty extraordinary, I have to say. There's an anecdote in Elvis Costello's book where Elvis Costello learned to read and write music, and he can write out orchestral scores. And Bob Dylan stopped in his trailer, and Elvis was writing out an orchestral score, and Dylan was very sort of disturbed by this because it was so far beyond anything he could imagine doing, and I think he was perhaps even slightly threatened. So anyway, you should flaunt this around other drummers.
Well, hey, Brad, are there any other drummers? Like, does Phil Collins do it? Who does it? Keltner? Anybody? Did Bonham?
I would assume both. All the aforementioned were certainly capable. Bonham, I don't know. I mean, his playing is so precise and so accurate.
Neil Peart?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You think he writes it all out? It's not all just feel?
Maybe in his past he did, but I think he's probably moved beyond notation, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Matt, I'm going to take the opportunity to correct you on your pronunciation of Neil Peart.
Peart.
Peart. Peart. Peart.
Thank you, Brian.
I tried to say it right in between. I was like, Neil Peart? Peart? So, because I wasn't sure. You're right, Peart. The name of Brian's autobiography is Beyond Notation.
We've stayed on this topic for longer than I expected, I have to say. So, Brian, on this album, I would say, I think it's the most sort of drum machine stuff that there's ever been on a National album. And you did one of my favorite things, which is going between program stuff and live stuff. I love that transition. So talk about that aspect and how that became part of the thing.
Well, I've been trying to attempt it for years now, unsuccessfully until now, I guess. Initially with the recording of Sad Songs for Dirty Lovers, we had some MIDI program drums for Reason. But I think it really started with my obsession with Stephen Morris of New Order and Joy Division, like how they would use both electric and acoustic elements, and just trying to copy that because I enjoyed that sound so much. And here, I think drum machine technology has advanced far enough that people who don't really know what they're doing, like myself, can approach it and just easily program and make, you know, little compositions on them.
And what was the hardest aspect of making this album for you, Brian? And then maybe I'll have Matt answer that as well.
Oh, geez. Well, I probably have the easiest work because I get to redo things a lot. I get to revisit a lot. And I think we sort of like, it's sort of a foundational element a lot of the time. So we sort of focus on that, and I get lots of swings, especially this time more so than others. But the most difficult, I mean, I think just starting from nothing and just like, let's hit some stuff and see what happens.
Making the record, that was the hard part.
How about you, Matt? Same answer.
I mean, that's a. Yeah. I will say this. It's like this record was less hard than in terms of like a less emotionally hard on me, less like sort of trying in terms of the anxiety and the timetable and rushing and being up all night and stuff. We kind of, you know, we all have weird different sleep patterns. I always wake up at 5 a.m. now, no matter what. I just can't help it. I love it. And I just get a lot of work done in the morning. And then other people roll in much later and stay up much later. And we had this kind of, and we were like, you know, the process was sometimes Bryce or Aaron were sending me stuff from Europe, you know, late at night. And then I'd work on it and send it to them, and they'd get up in the morning and do stuff and send it back. And it was, so then when we were in the studio, there's a pond outside. I don't know. It's been a long process, and it's a challenge. It's an uphill climb and all that kind of stuff. And it's stressful, but I can't say it was hard.
I must admit, on some level, it's always a slightly disillusioning when you find out that all the members of a band now live in different places. It sort of ruins that, like, monkey's illusion a little bit. Uh-huh. But so how does that affect things, if at all, that you're all kind of scattered now?
I mean, I lived upstairs from Aaron. He was my landlord. He was Corinne and both of our landlords. That's when we got married. We lived above Aaron. And then when we were dating, we lived above Bryce and his sister and two doors away. So we've been, you know, I've been living in the house or on the property of the Desner brothers, you know, for a long time. But even then, it was just, we would just email stuff each other. Even when in Brooklyn, when we had the studio in the backyard, yeah, I would go out, but most of the time I wouldn't leave my room. And like, they would leave hamburgers. Literally, Bryce would leave burgers outside the door, and I would, like, you know, I would come out in the middle of the night and get it and go right back in. You know, now we all live in the different cities, but now we have these things where we all camp out for like 10 days or 2 weeks at a time, and we work 24, you know, like at different times, but we're like sleeping late or sleep or getting up early or, you know, staying up late and 21st. It's just fun. It's like band camp. So, and we're going swimming in a pond and hiking and drinking beers, smoking weed, making rock songs. It's a blast. But it's a ton of work. It's a ton of work, but yeah, I actually think we collaborate more now, I think.
It's been 16 years since your first album, which is wild. That's way longer than like the Beatles ever were together, you know?
We're basically, had the Beatles not broken up, that's our story. You're welcome, culture. Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to answer Brian this one. Answer Brian this one.
I mean, we always put pressure on ourselves to succeed, but we've never really had any like great expectations. It was mostly just to serve the songs and write songs that we liked and get sounds that we liked. I mean, that sounds pretty obvious, I guess. I really don't know. I think it's just fate, maybe. The fact that we're also blood relatives probably plays a piece as well.
There's no small part of it is that we took care of each other. I'll just say it. You know, it's like all of us just stepped up against some things that could have ended it. You know, or we stepped right up to the edge a bunch of times, and one or all of us or a couple of us would remind us all why we're doing it, and a bunch of stuff, not just with regard to the band, but personal lives, health reasons, all kinds of stuff. We've done that for each other a number of different times over the years, and we've forgiven each other for shit we've said to each other. That's the other reason. I think like people like that, I think Liam and Noel just forgive each other. Just forgive it. You know, come on, forgive each other. Play a great show. Stop it.
I wonder if having two pairs of brothers, and we only have a couple minutes left, I wonder if having two pairs of brothers canceled out the sort of Kinks Oasis type problem, or also I think you're a little bit of different personality types than those guys.
I don't know. Also maybe just the product of where and when and how we grew up. I don't know. You just kind of stick with it. You stand by your family and just thick and thin, you know? Yeah.
I mean, I got a brother that drives me bananas too, so I get it. I think like we all can empathize, and maybe that's what it is.
That's true. If he was in the band, that would be a very interesting and different dynamic.
He was for a year and a half.
Right. As a very excellent documentary establishes, yeah. So we've been talking to two members of The National who have a really great album, Sleep Well Beast, out in September. Matt and Brian, I really appreciate you coming here. And so this has been Rolling Stone Music Now. We'll be back next week at 1 p.m. here on Volume. And in the meantime, be sure to download us as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to us as well, and maybe leave us a really nice review on iTunes. And we will see you next week with more from Rolling Stone Music Now.